You're listening to KSCO, Santa Cruz, Salinas, Monterey, and San Jose, and 104 FM. This is From the Bookshelf. I'm Gary Shapiro. Thanks for joining me.
Historian Jacqueline R. Brateman is my guest. She's an expert on California political history. And in addition to attending my brother's bar mitzvah, Jacqueline R. Brateman has written an excellent new book, which is both a political and show business story. It's called She Damn Near Ran the Studio, The Extraordinary Lives of Ida R. Coverman. Jacqueline Brateman, welcome to From the Bookshelf.
Thank you very much for having me.
Coverman? Oh.
Coverman.
So you and I, we both grew up in Southern California. I mentioned you were a friend of my brother's, the author and dramatist, Bruce Shapiro. And I was always interested in Hollywood history. But what about you? Were you more fascinated with politics or show business?
Well, I came to Ida through California politics when I was writing my dissertation. And I came across the name Ida Coverman. The political scientist sort of passed me, you know, mailed me some information. And my dissertation was about Catherine Phillips Edson, who is featured also in the book. And at that time, it didn't resonate with me. I didn't know who Ida Coverman was, but I put it aside. And then over the years, I kind of kept going back to her. So it was through California politics, women in California politics. But oddly enough, it wasn't until I was writing my book about Stanley Mosk that I found some papers of Ida Coverman's, because there are no real archives of hers. And after I finished the Stanley Mosk book, I went back to Coverman and I had to learn Hollywood history. I had to learn as much as I could because that was not my field. So I came to it from a whole different direction.
Well, you know, I've read a lot about Hollywood. I've read a couple of biographies of Louis B. Mayer, a couple of which you mentioned. And Scott Iman has been on the show here talking to me. And I read about Judy Garland a lot. And I've read histories of MGM. But I've heard the name, but there's the degree to which the role, the powerful role she played in Hollywood was unknown to me. And do you think that that's sexism involved in not crediting her or what?
I don't know. I don't think so. I think she did a lot to hide her background. At some point, there was sort of this mythical narrative about her. While she was living, she didn't really talk about, or at least from the sources that I have, no one really knew where she came from. Everybody just assumed, oh, she worked for Herbert Hoover and then Mayer hired her. And so the same stories were repeated over and over. And I found that I might have been the only person to say, well, who really was she? They're saying she, you know, was this political person, but they never really talk about it. And so I think she did a lot to hide her background. And then because there was such an easy narrative of, oh, well, she did this and then Louis did this, blah, blah, blah. This was just passed on for a long time. But could it be that women were ignored in the histories? Possibly. I think she did a lot of that herself as well, hiding.
Right, because she's been referred to as a secretary or an executive secretary, but she was a lot more than that. She had secretaries who worked for her, right?
Right. And whatever her title was, as she even pointed out, in the one real insightful article in 1950 about where she's talking about what she does every day, the reporter went on a little tour with her. That was the most insightful, and it really didn't matter what her title was, because Mayer, just whatever she wanted to do was fine. And I don't even think she knew the breadth of her influence on Hollywood when she first joined, that she would be a talent scout, that she would be a cultural influencer in not just MGM, but in the city of Los Angeles. So she came in more as a political figure, right-hand person who was very well connected. But, you know, her third incarnation because she was already, don't quote me on any detail or name, but she was already in her early 50s by the time she got to MGM. So, you know, who knew how it was going to unfold? She could have just remained, you know, a secretary, not just a secretary, but in a more narrow category. But how it unfolded, I don't think she even anticipated.
Yes, well, the word lives is in the title of your book as opposed to life, because of all of these things that happen, I mean, a good part of your book happens before she ever gets to Hollywood. And I want to talk about some of that. And also the influences that some of those things eventually had on her as a star maker. Swimming, for instance, she was very involved in swimming. And then, you know, one of the strangest, I mean, I think today people might think it's strange. Nobody thought so at the time. But Esther Williams' career as a Hollywood Broadway, I mean, a Hollywood musical star, in which in every musical she was swimming. It's kind of an unusual thing to have a swimmer be a musical star. And that was largely because of Ida Koverman's interest.
Koverman, yeah. That's the assumption I make. I can't prove it in terms of documents or anybody actually saying it, but the coincidence is actually too strong. And in fact, there are no real records about MGM. So that was one of the difficulty in writing the book. And there are less about Ida Koverman. So I just want to address that. You said the early part of the book, most of the book is about her early career. I do want to just say this book had many audiences as I was writing, and I was researching and finding things as I went. I had no clue where this story was going to go, even after I got the contract. I hadn't written it. Uh-huh. But I was speaking to historians of Los Angeles, of Hollywood, of film, of in MGM, of women in politics, of California politics, Southern, you know, there was a whole audience that I was addressing when I wrote. So of course I had to cut 150 pages in the end. But I think because she's a Hollywood figure, there's an interest in a popular interest and a scholarly interest. But the fact that her legacy really is much more profound in the emerging rise of Los Angeles and Southern California and politics, that was to me at least the most familiar terrain, but also it's an entire life of someone who lived three separate incarnations, really. And they were very separate. So I couldn't please everybody. I didn't have, you know, the inside gossip of things. A lot had been written about everybody, but I think I had a new cast, you know, on Mayer, Garland, Hopper, you know, and then what was out there, a lot of it was, you know, incorrect in fact or interpretation, I believe. So I just wanted to set the record straight, but I'm hoping somebody else will find even more if this person interests them.
Yeah, it's just opening up a story. That's what right. You're
that yeah, no one, and I just want to say, I think part of it is that because there were a few sources, and she's also not, she's a conservative Republican, so maybe there wasn't an attraction to her, but I mean, so was Hedda Hopper, you know, so were a lot of Hollywood.
There was people. Luella Parsons, right?
Yeah, exactly. That we are fascinated by. So we don't have to like them, but she is exceptionally fascinating in the layers of her life. So sorry to provide that preface, but there were a lot of people I was talking to, and then I had to try to pull it back and just, you know.
Uh-huh. Well, so what's the most significant part of the first part of her life? She was involved in some terrible scandal that made her want to change her name, change her identity.
Well, this was what was completely hidden from anybody. It was because I think the reason it was hidden, and I'll tell you what, emphasize what it was because she was not married. She was Ida Brockway, Ida Randhouse, or I may be pronouncing wrong, Ida R. Brockway. And nobody ever put the two together. So when I found that there was a year or two where she was in syndicated national newspapers as part of this, one of the biggest embezzlement scandals in history to that time, of the treasurer of the big four railroads, not the big four in the West with Crocker and all those people, but the big four in the Midwest. She was working at the U.S. Customs House, but was friends with several people who were one. The treasurer at the big four railroad was embezzling, but he was being blackmailed by the lover of a former colleague. And Ida Brockway was friends with the lover. And I won't go into detail, but the whole thing blew up when the embezzlement was discovered. And Ida Brockway was blamed for having this years-long scandal that ended up with, at the time, was an enormous amount of money. Now we have billions and scandals, but this was $625,000 or, you know, $750,000 over years that this man had been stealing. But it turns out his colleague had been stealing the man before. The whole thing was corrupt. So she was targeted, and there was a warrant for her arrest as a witness when she left town. This was in the newspapers for 2 years, but the connection of her and what she became had never been made, because what she did after testifying and the details of all of the incidents to me were fascinating, more fascinating than a drama, a movie script that you could write. And this was real. This is what inspired her, I believe, that she had to get out of town. She had to get out of Cincinnati. And she had known Oscar Coverman. And, to the best of my knowledge, and even her later relatives, it was a marriage of convenience. But what I show is they never really lived together. And yet it gave her legitimacy. It gave her a new name. It gave her sort of more of a status. That even though she was a working woman, she was a professional, but she was able to now circulate in more respectable places. And that's when her leadership talents began to show with the Women's Swimming Organization and helping to get women competitive swimmers allowed in the Olympics, because they had been banned from the Olympics. I mean, not banned, they were never allowed to compete. And once she did that, she moved to California.
Well, so. One of the things in that little section of the book that you remind me of now that I found so amusing, you know, every year the Sports Illustrated publishes their swimsuit issue, in which there's hardly any swimsuits in it at all. And you talk about the swimsuits that women were forced to wear, and that Ida Coverman battled against those.
Well, Kellerman, the Australian swimmer, Kellerman, blocking on the first name, but she's the one who actually, the Million Dollar Mermaid is a movie about Kellerman.
About her.
Right. Mm-hmm. So she was the one who was supposedly arrested for wearing a bathing suit, and she was, you know, fighting against these very heavy, and that Coverman likely wore these same things, but women wore two-piece bathing suits and stockings, and they were usually made out of wool. And so I suggest, even though Ida Coverman was an expert swimmer, you lack buoyancy when you're wearing a wool outfit and wet, and it's wet and it's dragging you down. And so when women were able to break out of being all covered up at the beach, it was a liberation, but it was symbolic and real, you know. So, I don't have evidence of her being part of that fight, but certainly Kellerman was someone she highly respected, and she was involved in helping to promote women's organizations in swimming, women's competitive swimming. And then she came out to California and did the same thing, and actually there were a few bylines of hers in the LA Times, which I found very, very late in the writing process. But she actually had a byline, and she was reporting on the Huntington dunk and, you know, the Long Beach swim, all of these extravaganza, swimming extravaganzas that were popular in New York, and she helped to bring it out west. There were a couple instances where Duke, the father of surfing, was performing, but these were mermaids, mermen. These were billed as, you know, swimming galas, extravaganzas, and it just seemed too coincidental that she was involved in these and then came to MGM. And, you know, years later, you have a competitive swimmer starring in movies. So,
yeah, I mean, Esther Williams didn't just make one or two movies. Like, I mean, I don't know how many skater Sonia Henie made, but she didn't make that many. But Esther Williams made 10 or 12 or 15 movies as a
swimmer. And they had the whole, you know, stage and the pool and everything, you know, way there for her. So it was her own arena, really.
I'm Gary Shapiro. This is From the Bookshelf on KSCO, and we're chatting this week with Jacqueline R. Brateman. Her book is called She Damn Near Ran the Studio, The Extraordinary Lives of Ida R. Coverman. Ida Coverman not only helped get Herbert Hoover elected President of the United States, but she was a shaping hand in the golden age of Hollywood as an executive secretary at Metro-Goldwyn-Mayer.
Jacqueline Brateman, in your book, She Damn Near Ran the Studio, The Extraordinary Lives of Ida R. Coverman, you talk about Ida Coverman's involvement in the presidency of Herbert Hoover. And I was wondering what you thought about Herbert Hoover in terms of the, do you think it's a similar impulse that led people to vote for Donald Trump that led people to vote for Herbert Hoover, this sort of idea that he was not a politician?
Not at all.
No,
not at all. I don't really, I see, when I was writing the book, it was actually the primary season of 2016. And so there were many similarities in terms of what is the soul, the Republican Party was trying to find its soul in California in 1920, because California had been a progressive state for at least a decade. There was the Hiram Johnson machine. But as Southern California began to grow in population and had more conservative politics, and this, you know, was historic in many ways, labor, you know, open shop, closed shop, many differences between Northern California and Southern California. But as Southern California began to rise in political influence, there was this, and the tension was always there, but between Ida Coverman as a conservative Republican and Catherine Phillips Edson, who I mentioned before for my dissertation, was one of the leading progressive Republicans, who was a state official, had helped bring women into the Republican Party. Women could vote in California in 1911. So women had been voting long before 1920. But 1920 was an important year because, you know, everybody anticipated a new, by August, everyone could vote in the country. So women were being rounded up. They were being courted. They were being organized from both progressive and conservative sides. Well, Hoover was a very highly respected individual who had made his name as without everybody knowing the details of, you know, perhaps the issues of mining and exploiting peoples and terrain. He was a self-made entrepreneur, engineer, and there were many other individuals like him, especially from Stanford. But he became one of the most well-loved individuals after World War I, as you might know, obviously, from working with Belgian Relief. And he appealed to both sides as a progressive, but was he really a conservative Republican or a liberal Republican? Nobody knew initially. Both Democrats were courting him. Progressives in the Democratic Party were courting him. So he had a broad appeal, but it was because he was a humanitarian. It was because he was a person who helped other people, refugees, starving people. It wasn't because he was building buildings and, you know, making deals, and obviously there was no television. Radio wasn't, you know, that big of a thing. So his reputation grew not from a culture of a visual soundbite culture. It grew from what people learned about him through, you know, print media and through word of mouth, and a reputation that appealed across the board. And it wasn't until sometime in 1920 when it was finally clear, when he was appointed to the Harding administration. He's a conservative Republican, and that's what helped fuel Ida Coberman and her ally, Ralph Arnold. Okay, it's clear now. You know, the progressives aren't going to get him. He's a conservative Republican. And so I would not characterize him at all in terms of a Trump-like figure, but in terms of the split in the party, it was very, very powerful. And in fact, when I was writing just one of the chapters about Ida Coberman as the conservative, Catherine Edson as the progressive, I wrote a paper that turned into a chapter. And it's actually these two women who represent the great divide, because we tend to think of the women's movement as a monolithic thing. We tend to think of most movements as monolithic things. But the reality is there was a great divide among women, especially in 1923 when the Equal Rights Amendment was proposed, and that opened the door. So in California, especially with our progressive dominance, the conservatives are fighting to take control again. And so these two women actually represent this very fundamental divide in our country, but in California in particular, and in the Republican Party. So Hoover, this all started around 1920. It took another 8 years for him to become president because clearly there was a shift of more conservative Republican presidents after Wilson. So I think it says a lot about the party, the divisions in the country and the party, but not Hoover himself.
Yeah. It's interesting that the perception has always been that the film industry and that the entertainment industry is largely liberal. But when we read your book, we see, and I think that was true then, people thought that then, but so many of the Hollywood elite were conservative Republicans. All the movie stars that you mentioned, Robert Taylor and, I don't know, Gary Cooper and Adolph Monju and all those guys were very conservative. And I guess even Irving Thalberg and, of course, Louis B. Mayer were really conservative Republicans.
Right, right. I think, Steve Ross sort of laid the terrain. Other people did too. But when he wrote Hollywood Left and Right, he was sort of setting up. He was wonderfully helping to set up my story, which I didn't know at the time, but because he does talk about Ida Coberman more than most people do as an ally of Mayer. But the whole point of his book, of course, is that, yes, Hollywood was left and right. There, again, we tend to, if we don't think in monolithic terms, we always think in bipolar terms, right? Right, left, good, bad, left wing, right. Yeah. So I think he set up that dichotomy beautifully. And then what I argue, well, he talks about the marriage of politics and Hollywood. And then I come in and argue, yes, but Ida Coberman was the matchmaker. And I want to add the role of women, organized women, conservative, organized, professional women. And these professional women were also Hollywood actors. And the whole network of professional women that there's a lot of new scholarship. Again, I'm not even coming from women in film, women in Hollywood, working class women, although that was part of what I did earlier. But the network that Coberman carves out is our professional working women. Many of them are single, not all of them, but these are not middle class women of leisure reformer types. These are professional women who are joining organizations, creating policy or trying to do away with policy. And the women actors, Irene Dunne and, I have brain fog, but but the network of women actors, Jeanette MacDonald, I could look at notes, but you can figure them out. The network of women that you see over the two decades in presidential politics and other activities, it's a network of conservative women and men, but these people socialized together. They did politics together. They were aggressive, activist, political people. So, yeah, there were in the 40s with the liberals and, you know, that more well-known story. But this was clearly a whole new layer of political actors in the movie industry that I don't think anybody has really looked at. And yes, so, but again, even it's interesting that you think of Hollywood as liberal, but then what was the Red Scare? What was the Hollywood 10? I mean, this shows that, you know, there was this other side, that there were, it wasn't just people crying out or advocating against the hearings. That actually HUAC started in the late 30s. It wasn't until McCarthy, though, that most people talk or know about the investigations into Hollywood. Those had started years before. Mm. But so it wasn't just the liberals, you know, agitating against them, you know. It really was people inside that were encouraging, let's clean out Hollywood. Let's, the American Legion and all the people that the Koverman and her network were associated with. It was a very divided industry.
Yeah, so she wasn't opposed to the House on American Activities Committee coming and asking questions of the people working at MGM.
Well, I don't have evidence one way or the other, but I do by association. That the people that she associated with were named in one of the later hearings as a look back, as these are the individuals who didn't go around, you know, agitating against HUAC. And she was one of the individuals along with the more conservative and direct, you know, directors, producers, you know, it was all along the line in the industry. So it's by association that I can make these assumptions. And the fact that she was the one who got Hedda Hopper, you know, started in her career, or at least, you know, catapulted it to the level. And the way I describe their friendship is that they were a team. Sometimes they were a team. They'd go out on the road, and Ida Koverman was sort of the straight man, and then let Hedda Hopper, you know, do the real vocalizing. And so I can only assume that there was a simpatico based on what Hedda Hopper, you know, what her reputation became.
You're listening to From the Bookshelf. I'm Gary Shapiro on KSCO, and we're talking with Jacqueline R. Brateman. Her book is called She Damn Near Ran the Studio, The Extraordinary Lives of Ida R. Koverman. Ida Koverman helped shape the golden age of Hollywood as Louis B. Mayer's executive secretary.
Jacqueline Brateman, when Talking Pictures came to Hollywood in 1927, it opened the door for singing stars and musicals that had never happened before because they were silent. And I think the first impulse was popular or jazz music, of course, Jolson being the first. And then at MGM particularly, there was a movement to more classical singing. You mentioned Jeanette MacDonald and Deanna Durbin and Catherine Grayson, eventually Mario Lanza. And a lot of that had to do with Ida Koverman.
Yes, I believe so, that the first individual who was a great star at the time, again, my brain is blocking, but the opera singer.
Lawrence Tibbett.
Yes. Yes. Thank you very much.
Well, I particularly remember reading about Lawrence Tibbett in your book because Laurel and Hardy appear in his movie, The Rogue Song.
That's right. Right. Again, these are details. I only know enough that I could put it together, but you would know it, you know, more viscerally than I, but that it was included, that Laurel and Hardy were included. How are we going to market this? You know, what if it doesn't go over? But the point is that Tibbett's family even was saying, you know, if it wasn't for Ida Koverman, he would never have even been in this movie. And it, you know, then it was just the beginning. She brought in Nelson Eddy for Jeanette MacDonald. Mm-hmm. She brought, again, this was the narrative, and everything I found supported it, but obviously there were other individuals involved in all of these people's careers, but she was a driving force. Mario Lanza was one of the biggest Hollywood stars of all time before Elvis, before the Beatles, before music, popular music, you know, and the movies, just incredibly popular. So, but I also write about, she was with this idea of Deanna Durbin and Judy Garland, mm-hmm. right? They were both at MGM, and the debate about who we're going to keep, what are we going to do with these people? The fact that she brought in Judy Garland is one thing, but the contest of, you know, what are we going to do is on the cusp of really American culture's shift from more traditional classical music to more swing and jazz. And so there's actually a movie short called Every Sunday that demonstrates this, the contest between these genres. And they're both incredible. Deanna Durbin is this incredible angelic voice. In fact, there's a video of her doing the Irish song, You Take the High Road. Again, my brain is not with details, but I had listened to that over and over with tears in my eyes. And what a brilliant voice. But at any rate, so she's doing the angelic opera, then you hear Judy Garland belt it out, and this is incredible talent. Well, of course, the story is not a clean one. There's a lot of debate about it, of how they ended up keeping Judy Garland and letting Deanna Durbin go. But however that ended up happening, and I do kind of go into the detail, Deanna Durbin goes over to Universal and becomes one of the biggest, highest paid stars. And the rumor is, although people counter, is that she actually saved Universal from bankruptcy. So I think Ida Koverman can take credit for that, because she had promoted both of these young women. And then, of course, Judy Garland became her little starling, and she helped to nurture her career. But she had a couple of years she had to keep pushing to get Judy Garland.
Yeah. And she kind of protected, or tried to protect, Judy Garland from the ravages of studio life.
I believe so. The only real way we know is from other people's accounts of how she helped help sneak her food, and kind of fought with Mayer a little bit about how she had to be on these strict diets. And they were very close. And because Ida Koverman had no children, and I also point out she was known as a widow, but she was not a widow. She was a divorcee. But at any rate, this was what I interpret as the closest relationship she had with having a child, having a daughter. And they were very close. But as Garland matured, and most of the story is about Garland's troubles and her issues, that is all well talked about, but I was absolutely thrilled when I found that not only was Garland's maturing troublesome in many ways, but she was maturing into a liberal Democrat. And here her mentor and her boss are these conservative Republicans. And so I basically argue part of the split with MGM and Koverman and her mother was ideological, because Koverman had been nurturing people in, you know, finding people to mentor politically, and Judy Garland was pushing away. I thought that was a pretty profound kind of insight.
So in other words, although politics led Ida Koverman into the film industry, she never left politics behind.
Right, never left politics behind. And that's the other thing that, for example, well, as an aside, it turns out there were a lot of Hollywood people that were Christian Scientists or followers of Science of Mind, and sometimes they're conflated and sometimes they're separate. But Ida Koverman was a Christian Scientist, and just by chance, most of the people around her were either converted or, you know, had been. So there's this alliance. I'm not saying with Judy Garland there was an issue, but she nurtured people, and one of them, of course, became George Murphy, who was a real student of Ida Koverman's in terms of politics. And it's also, I think it was Steve Ross who also sort of made the connection that if it wasn't for George Murphy, then we wouldn't have had Ronald Reagan, and then maybe we wouldn't have had Trump. I do make that leap as well, but the clear, George Murphy acknowledges he was one of Ida's boys, and at her funeral, he's very proud to say that, and he followed in her footsteps. Now, he had his own connections as well, but politics never left Koverman. Koverman never left politics, and she created this network within the studio system, within the city, really.
Well, having been such a big supporter of Hoover, but for the majority of the time she was at MGM, there was President Roosevelt. How did she feel about Roosevelt? How did she feel about America's entry into World War II and so on?
Well, I don't have actual documentation or evidence about how she responds to lots of world events, I have to say. But in 1932, she and Mayer and their ally, Mendel Silverberg, who was an iconic attorney in Los Angeles in the Jewish community, and but who was raised, oddly enough, was raised as a Christian Scientist, as one previous author points out, and then became Jewish, or found his Jewishness. But Mendel Silverberg, Ida Koverman, Louis B. Mayer, this network that's inside of MGM, it's now 1932, and you know they're going to push for Hoover's reelection. Well, by then, it was unlikely, but in September of 1932, you know, the campaign season was just starting. They were going to have a full out effort to reelect Hoover, and that's when Jean Harlow's husband of just a couple months is found dead. Paul Byrne, the producer at MGM, is found dead. And the mystery about did he commit suicide or was he murdered is a moment right before the campaign season starts. And so the stories about how Mayer deals with this tragedy is the stuff of a lot of scandal, you know, salacious kinds of stories, mythology, mysteries of Hollywood. But when I realized that for 2 days, this network of people were gathered together to see how do we deal with this? What are we going to do with Harlow? Is the DA going to, you know, did Harlow kill him? You know, was she going to be indicted? But the way I saw it is that these are people that have been together for the last eight years pushing Hoover, pushing their mission, and everything could just blow up because of this death. And even though, you know, in the bigger picture, Hoover was, you know, it was the depths of the Depression, all of that stuff, but nevertheless, it was a window in time. Oh, it's not just Paul Byrne, Jean Harlow, MGM. It's the last 8 years of California politics, national politics, coming to a halt. And all of these people represent, you know, a decade of major changes in Southern California.
Well, in your book, you definitely make it seem as though Paul Byrne's suicide was not a suicide, even though obviously you don't know, but you must have a theory. What do you think happened to Paul Byrne?
I have to say, I couldn't tell you. I think it's a suicide. The narrative, the dueling narratives are that Mayer, and let's put it this way, I'm going to take Ida Koverman's word for it as told to someone else years later. And her understanding of it was, it was murder. But Louis B. Mayer went in and with Whitey Hendry, MGM's police chief, who Ida Koverman was very good friends with, and, you know, manipulated the scene. And Mendel Silverberg, who was this big politico in the Republican Party, and then became a much more well-known figure in Los Angeles in the 40s and 50s in the Jewish community. He was on retainer at MGM. He became Gene Harlow's attorney. So basically, they took over this crisis, and the fear that the DA Buren Fitz was going to indict Harlow. So the theory is Mayer manipulated everything in order to avoid Harlow being indicted, but that also the district attorney was in the pocket of Louis B. Mayer. And the only other connection you can say that might be true is that Ida Koberman's right-hand woman for the last 8 years, or at least through the campaigns to try to elect Hoover, was Nellie Kelly. Nellie Kelly worked in Buren Fitz's office, in the DA's office, and she had been one of the primary organizers that worked with Ida Koberman to bring women into the Republican Party. So now you've got Ida Koberman in the inner circle, Mendel Silverberg, Nellie Kelly in the DA's office. And so there is this big question. What is he going to do? Well, the Ida Koberman believed Whitey Hendry, the police chief at MGM, with Louis B. Mayer, went in, changed the scene, and it was actually a murder. And then Paul Burns' common law wife, who had been back east in an institution that Gene Harlow knew about, the other theory, well, the theory of the murder is that it possibly was his common law wife who came, shot him, and then she was found floating in the river up north a few weeks later. So that's one side of the story. I'm not saying Koberman says that, but her theory, as told, I think it was Sam Katz, but don't quote me, was that this was a manipulated scene, and the suicide note had disappeared, but it ended up with Mendel Silverberg, who was her attorney, and she paid for the funeral. Harlow paid for the funeral of the common law wife. Or paid for the tombstone and taking care of it. So there's a lot of credibility that it really wasn't a suicide. On the other side, the more common accepted view is Mayer also learned about the insecurities that Paul Byrne had, and that he couldn't meet up to the expectations of being the spouse of the sexiest woman in the world, and he killed himself. I don't buy that. I'm not saying it was a manipulated murder, but I just don't buy that reason, because, you know, I think they were actually very close and they knew each other.
It wouldn't have come as a surprise.
Exactly. So,
yeah. Well, it's a fascinating book. Jacqueline R. Brateman is my guest, and the book is called She Damn Near Ran the Studio, The Extraordinary Lives of Ida R. Koverman. And we've just kind of just get the tip of the iceberg of this book. And so I recommend it to everybody. And Jacqueline Brateman, thank you so much for talking to us on From the Bookshelf.
Thank you so much. Really, I appreciate being on your show. Thank you. I'll see you at the next bar mitzvah.
That's it for this week's From the Bookshelf. I hope you enjoyed the program and will come back and see us again next week. In the meantime, check out our podcast page at fromthebookshelf.com. You can subscribe to our podcast wherever you subscribe to podcasts, and you can like us on Facebook. From the Bookshelf is produced by Francis Venegas and Ollie Jackson. I'm Gary Shapiro. Thanks for listening.